this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, May 25th, 2008, and this is show number 153. Hey, I want to thank all of you sending your congratulations on the third-year anniversary show. I'm still glowing about that. I even like all the ones that say, I really meant to make a recording, but... I guess I like those because I've done that myself. I'm still kicking myself for not doing one I'd planned for the Lab Rats anniversary show. Anyway, thanks to all. It really was fun. Sure hope you guys have a lot of time to listen because, I don't know, it's pretty packed. I'm going to keep an eye on the clock, and if it gets too long, I may break off chit-chat across the pond and make it a separate feed because this could go long. So let me kick in. Well, after the show where I had my mother the geek on, I got a ton of nice feedback from you on how fun she is. That made me feel great, and her. She was so proud that I called her a geek, too. You know, it's funny how that word has changed meaning, isn't it? It used to be an insult, and now it's a compliment. Well, I thought I'd give you a little update on Mom. This afternoon, she called me on the phone and asked me, what's the difference between a Twitter and a tweeter? I loved it. She's on the very cutting edge, wanting to understand all this technical stuff we're all having so much fun with. I want to be my mom when I grow up. Well, good friend of the show, George, sent in another audio review. Let's sit back and take a listen.
Hi, Allison. George in Tulsa. That guy who sent in a couple of terrible-sounding MP3s. If this sounds better, and it should, I'm trial testing Wiretap Studio and have a new Logitech USB desktop mic. Credit, or blame, to you and Jane in Perth. You tapped my perfectionist streak. What I'm sending in today is about security, and was triggered by your recent chit-chat with Bart about Windows. I manage money for my employer, which is a charitable foundation. As charitable foundations go, it isn't big. I'd bet the petty cash box up at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is worth more than our entire endowment. On the other hand, there's enough here to charter a Gulfstream and flee to a hospitable foreign land and comfortably sip umbrella drinks for a very long time. That is, if the hospitable foreign land doesn't have an extradition treaty. So what does all this have to do with technology with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias? 3 years ago, my son was reading free sci-fi books on the internet on our home XP machine. He paid no attention to the fact the site he was reading them on redirected him to URL ending with .ru. I was horrified to notice over his shoulder that the firewall was flashing alert, 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 and reporting a scan of all the machine's ports while the kid just kept reading. I clicked to see where the probe originated, and the firewall traced it back to Moscow. I promptly pulled all the wires and had some unpleasant words with the kids. I virus scanned the system and didn't find any problems, so I thought the firewall had done its job and all was okay. But a couple of days later, that machine and our machines at work began acting strangely. Spybot Search and Destroy identified a Trojan which apparently had attached itself to the root and boot sector because nothing I could throw at it would clean it off. I presume whatever it was crawled from home to work on a USB flash drive I used to take work files back and forth. That very day, I ordered Macs for all three of us at work. I also bought the Intego security suite just for a bit more protection, even though I'm often told it is overkill. Still, the possibility someone might get into the broker accounts I manage through the net is pretty scary, and Intego cheap by comparison. Imagine a criminal sucking down umbrella drinks on a beautiful island while I'm breaking rocks with a sledgehammer and I might get out for good behavior in a decade or so. That possibility is why I've gone one step beyond using a Mac with extra security software and long cryptic passwords. I obtained radio security tokens from our brokers. They're little devices about the size of a USB flash drive. Every minute, one receives a new, unique, random number. To access a broker account requires not only the user ID, but a password and the current random number string for the token tied to that account. So long as I have the tokens in my possession, no one should be able to access these accounts, even if they somehow guess or capture my user ID and password. There's a similar scheme which involves the broker sending a text message with a number string to a cell phone or email address, but I prefer the tokens, which I think are less likely to be intercepted. What I do not know is if brokers will issue these tokens to any client or just clients whose accounts approach the Gates Foundation's petty cash drawer. But if you have money in an internet bank or brokerage account, and it's money you can't afford to lose, I suggest you call your broker and ask for a security token. And don't forget your retirement accounts. I was able to get one for my wife's HAL 9000 retirement account, money we'll need when those nursing home bills come due.
Well, George, I can't believe you went from, I swear I'm never going to do another audio review, to such a great and well thought out review. Your audio quality is spectacular, and I'm glad you're bringing some security issues to the forefront, because I don't worry about that as much as I probably should, but I'm glad there are people who worry about that for us. Thanks again for sending that in. Do you have a car? Is it a Honda or an Acura? Do you hate going to the dealer to have maintenance and repairs done on it? Okay, one more question. Do you live in the LA or Orange County areas of California? If all of the answers to this question are yes, then I want you to consider calling Honda Bob for all your Honda or Acura needs. Honda Bob is a trustworthy mechanic. No, seriously, I'm not kidding. Stop laughing. I am not kidding. I'm not joking. Okay, fine. You don't have to listen to me. Keep going to that creepy dealer who steals you blind and gets paint overspray on your car when all you wanted was an oil change. Keep reading 13-year-old copies of Field & Stream magazine while you sit on plastic chairs in the waiting room next to a sweaty guy named Guido. I'll be relaxing in my own home while Honda Bob fixes my car in the driveway. Oh, okay, so now you're listening. Well, do as so many before you have done and call Honda Bob at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email over at hdabob@aol.com and enter the world of auto maintenance bliss. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
Who do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, it's time for that portion of the show where we entertain dumb questions. Those questions you're afraid to ask because you figure everyone else probably knows the answer already and you don't want to look stupid. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I answered the dumb question, how to switch windows in Word? Because on Windows, you can do it with a keystroke and the person was a recent switcher, wanted to know how to do it on the Mac. I came up with a really complex answer, but Doug Ingram from Always Apples at alwaysapples.com.au in Australia wrote in with a better answer. He says, I wanted to help you and the listeners out with a further answer to one of the dumb questions in by a subscriber recently. In show number 150, you answered a listener's question regarding keyboard switching between Windows in Word 2004. I agree that the official help solution of Command F6 is clumsy. You've overlooked a simpler and more obvious one, though, and that is Command Tilde. The tilde character is just below the escape key on most keyboards. You don't need to push the shift key, so maybe it's best described as Command apostrophe, I guess. I say it's an obvious one because it used to switch between Windows and most Mac applications. Heck, it even works in Apple stickies. Photoshop is one of the few applications where Command Tilde doesn't work. Sometimes when I'm waiting on hold for a service provider, etc., I sit there and I Command Tilde my windows and applications just to keep myself awake. If you get really bored, you can create animations by opening your favorite drawing package, creating several stick figures in new windows, stacking the windows on top of each other, and then Command Tilde to make the stick figures appear to move. Okay, Doug, you've outdone me in the silly ideas here. I tell you what, why don't you zip up your stick figures for us, and I'll post them on the web, and we could all play with them. That would be fun. This is a technical show, you know. We need to test this out and make sure that it works as you say. I am glad you showed the easier and far more consistent way to do the window switching. That Command Tilde works everywhere. Of course, except for Photoshop. My only problem is I keep reaching too far and I keep hitting Command Escape, so suddenly my screen goes black and I panic as Front Row comes up. Gotta get that keyboard thing down quick, because I have a heart attack every time I do that. I should also mention that in one of the Chit Chat Across the Pond episodes, Bart actually did try to explain the Command Tilde thing to me, but I didn't follow him at the time. You both get homework assignment credit on this one. There is a way to do it in Photoshop, by the way. It turns out that over on MacTips.com, they explained how to switch windows in Photoshop. I think it's actually a programming error because they forgot to change it to Command Tilde like it is on the Mac, and they use Control Tilde on just like you would on Windows. You can also do it with Control Tab or Command Shift Tilde, but that's too many options to remember. Just remember, every application is Command Tilde except Photoshop, where Adobe forgot to do it right for the Mac, so it's Control Tilde. Got it? Good. All right, Daniel wrote in with two dumb questions. Number one, on my laptop, I have a card reader, and I recently burned out my camera, but I still have the SD card. Can I use this for ferrying Word documents onto another computer with a card reader? I'm worried this might corrupt it or something. I think this is a perfect dumb question, because I know lots of people have had this question. In fact, I've kind of had it too, and I never went around to figuring out if it could work. Well, I found this over on sdcard.org. The question said, can you save data in different formats such as audio, video, still pictures, and documents onto a single SD memory card? The answer is yes. You can save data in different formats as long as the card has sufficient memory capacity. However, to play or transfer the data, you will need equipment that is compatible with the appropriate data format such as SD audio, SD video, and SDP document. I think that means yes, and for sure you won't corrupt it or anything. That's a great question. I think that if and when you want to use the SD card in a camera again, though, I'd let the camera reformat the card, or you'd be sure to run into difficulties. Or just buy another camera, and then you can use your SD card right away. Daniel's second question was, I watch videos on Hulu constantly, but whenever there's bad Wi-Fi, I can't watch anything. Is there anything that can fix that? Well, Daniel, this is like if you told me, sometimes as a firefighter, when I get to the fire, they will only give me a small garden hose so I can't put out fires. The same thing is true with dodgy Wi-Fi. The only thing that can fix it is good Wi-Fi or a wired connection. One option to get good Wi-Fi most of the time, if you can afford it, is to buy a wireless card from one of the cell companies, like the EVDO cards that Verizon and Sprint sell. These are inexpensive to buy after rebates. In fact, I've seen them as low as free. But like a cell phone plan, they make you commit to 2 years of around $60 US per month. I love mine. I use it everywhere, and it gives me respectable broadband, around 1.2 megabits down and 300 to 400 kilobits up, pretty much everywhere I can get a cell signal. It is expensive, though. That's a lot of money, so maybe you want to wait to watch Hulu rather than spend that kind of money. What a great question. Oh, and I like Hulu, too. I was late to work the other day because I was watching 30 Rock because Margaret told me about it. Hulu.com is cool. Pat wrote in with a really interesting dumb question. Here's what she said. Hi, Allison. Just in case you run out of dumb questions. That's not going to happen. Mail used to automatically create the draft mailbox and add a draft as soon as a new message was started. But now mail doesn't seem to do that anymore. Why not? Is there a setting I'm missing? It's annoying because I forget to hit the save as draft button, and then if I get interrupted while writing, or I have to search for something to add to a message, I end up having to search for the new message draft under 50 other open windows. I know I could hit the F3 key to find it, but it used to be so easy I just hit mail and draft. What am I missing? This was interesting because when I looked at it, I didn't have a drafts folder either until I created a draft. I had to save it. I thought I was brilliant and wrote back to Pat about it, but she wrote back that she didn't have a drafts folder even when she did save an email as a draft. I pondered the vast mystery of this for a couple of days, coming up with no answers, when Pat wrote to me again to say that her drafts folder had magically reappeared. I'm so glad I was able to be of help here. My work is done. Well, I think that's enough Dumb Question Corner for now. I have more of them from people, but I think I'm going to cut us off because, like I said, this is going to be a long show. And I really want to go listen to the Mars rover landing, so the Mars Phoenix landing, I should say. Well, I continue to really enjoy using Twitter, the 140-character microblog, time waster, entertainer, and technology resource. This week, Research Department Niraj found something, someone, really, really interesting to follow. Kind of ironic that I just mentioned it. It turns out we've launched a Mars probe called the Mars Phoenix, and they've created a Twitter identity for the Mars Phoenix. It's really cool. They're posting about how the navigation system is working, links to videos of how the lander will land. The movie is called 7 Minutes of Terror, and updates on their location. Like they had a post on 512 that said 406 million miles traveled since launch on August 4th, only 16 million more miles to Mars, or 654 million kilometers traveled, 25 million kilometers to go. They only posted one or two times a day, so it wasn't a deluge of facts, and it's going to land tonight, so this is going to get really exciting. They're actually on Ustream, and I'm going to run off and watch them. So by the time you hear this, you'll already know whether it blew up or not. There's also a price I must pay for my use of Twitter as a research tool. I got it in my head that I wanted to be able to send SMS messages to cell phones without getting my lazy self out of my chair to go fetch my cell phone. I thought I could look it up online. I could just ask Twitterville. Well, in just a few seconds, I had a ton of suggestions, but none that completely worked. So then I tweeted that I was going to go see Indiana Jones, the movie, but that all my little assistants on Twitter should keep working on this task for me while I was gone. Well, it did work, but WebWiz explained that I was then required to do a full review of the answers. See, there is a price to pay. Well, the answers I got back included, sneakytext.com, but that's a website, and it requires that I give my friend's cell phone number to a service provider, which sounded a little creepy. But of course, I went to do it anyway. I was going to test it on my own phone number. And I also had to tell them the service provider it was under, which in this case, since it was my iPhone, it was AT&T, which was not in the pull-down. So I vote no on sneakytext.com. Someone else suggested that if the person is in your address book, you could use iChat. But I couldn't figure out what to do in iChat. So I went straight over to the address book and I tried right-clicking on their phone number, and it popped up with an option to SMS through Skype. Well, that sounded good. Sounded great. But when I went to send it, there was a warning saying it cost 11.4 cents each to do it. Too rich for my blood. Okay, CallWave was another option, and this came with a dashboard widget for the Mac, which sounded like fun. But the first link I found on the Apple Store was broken. So then I went to the version tracker link that somebody sent me, but then the widget it installed simply didn't work. Couldn't type in any of the fields, and I couldn't use the pull-down. Rejected. Well, when I got back from the movies, a whole bunch of people explained how the iChat method works. It's really complicated, so be prepared to take notes here. Ready? In the menu bar, you select File, and you pull down to Send SMS. Did you get that? Yeah, that's it. Type in the phone number and you send your message. It was pretty funny that nobody even mocked me for not being able to figure it out. Well, a few weeks back, listener Lynn asked me to review the software Photo to Movie from LQ Graphics. I did my usual wing through it and see how well it worked, and I really thought it was a great product. I do have to mention that Margaret gave me a hard time. She said my movie was dorky, that it didn't do anything that you couldn't do in iMovie, and I explained that I'm not the video buff in the family. This review couldn't have come at a better time, though, because Steve was just about to start a new slideshow for our son's track team. He's done a lot of slideshows with music using iMovie, and they really come out beautifully, but he's always a bit frustrated by the lack of control on how the Ken Burns effect was applied. Invariably, it would decide to start at somebody's belly and end up with their head still cut off at the end of the Ken Burns effect. He was cautiously optimistic that Photo to Movie could give him a better result, and he gave it a full stress test. He wrote up his thoughts for me, so I thought I'd share them with you. Likes. Number one, very good control of zoom and pan. This was the problem I needed to solve since iMovie did not provide the control I wanted. I had full control over the size and centering of both start and stop frames with an added pause feature during the pan and zoom. Number two, slightly unintuitive controls for photo transitions, but I was eventually able to figure it out. Not as convenient as iMovie in this department. I was initially worried that I couldn't repeat a standard set of transition while importing a lot of photos. That's a problem if you're importing hundreds of photos like I was. But once I set it up in the tool, it imported all of the photos with the default transitions and durations just fine. There's a good selection of output format types too. I like that it had the option of creating a .dv output, which feeds directly into iDVD without loss and takes care of the lengthy encoding step. Still takes a while to encode in picture-to-movie, but at least you don't have to repeat this step in iDVD. It would be good to compare at some point in the future the encoding times between picture-to-movie and iDVD. Now on to Steve's dislikes. He says, does not play back the slideshow in a smooth manner. Lots of jumps and halts. Note this was a slideshow with 390 photos, so this may have stressed the tool. This presents a big problem if you're trying to compose a large slideshow and finally synchronize music with the slides, as I like to do. Number two, it crashes way too often, usually during one of the jumps, halts noted above. Again, I may have been stressing the tool beyond its limits, but it crashed on me every half hour or so. I learned to save early and often. You would think that a dual-core G5 would have the power to handle this level of processing, so I wonder about the efficiency of the code. Although it has great attributes that solved my zoom pan control problem, the jumpy playback and crashing will likely prevent me from buying the tool. I would like to see another version come out before I consider buying. If they at least solve the crash problem, I'd likely make the investment. Okay, this is back to Allison now. Now here's the great part. I took Steve's review in total and I emailed it off to the LQ Graphic folks, and Chris Meyer wrote back instantly thanking us for the open and honest feedback. He asked for specs on our system, especially how much video RAM we had in the G5, so that they can work on the performance side of things. Then he said, next, on the crash side of things, we work very hard to avoid crashes, so I'm surprised you're having so many. While 390 photos may be more than optimal in a slideshow, the software still shouldn't crash. We try to track down each and every crash report that we get. He then told me exactly where to find the crash logs to send to him, so he made it easy for me too. This is a perfect example of why I love shareware. Can you imagine getting this kind of response from Apple or any other big company? Chris's attitude was everything I can hope for, and I'm certain they will fix these issues shortly. While Steve is a tough critic, the video he produced of the track team was a huge hit. The way I judge a DVD, whether it was successful, is how many parents cry. And based on that, Photo to Movie with Steve driving was hugely successful. So as many of you know, I do reviews on the Mac ReviewCast for different applications, and I used to do them on my show and on his show both, but people started noticing I was kind of cheesing out and doing the same thing twice, so I stopped doing it. But I did a review on Tim's podcast recently that I would like you to hear, because at the end, there's a free giveaway for the first two people who write back to me. So I'm going to break my own rule, and here's that recording. Today I'd like to review a little piece of shareware that might just solve a problem you have. If you're like me, you've got attention deficit disorder. You just are distracted all the time, and as a result, you're flipping between applications just as the wind blows, and you lose track of time and appointments you should probably be taking care of. iCal is a great calendaring application, but some recent changes have made it a bit harder to enter data, in my opinion. And you do have to wait for it to launch when all you want to know is what time is my haircut. I also have a bad habit of flipping the calendar to some date in the future and not noticing that's how I left it, so I get all confused when I go to it again a day later or a day or two later and the dates are all weird and I'm looking at the wrong day on the wrong month. Well, enter the $15 shareware today, 1.1, from secondgearlick.com. That's secondgearlic.com. Today 1.1 is either a standalone application or a menu bar application. I don't think I've ever seen an application that could be whichever you want it to be. If it's a standalone application, you open it and close it just like any other. You can hide it and access the menus in the menu bar. If you tell it to be a menu bar application, it relaunches itself, and now it just runs all the time and is accessible through the menu bar. Just click once on the little icon, it pops up, click again, and it's gone. Well, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, though. What does today actually do? Today gives you a small, well-designed window showing you what's on the agenda for today. You can easily flip from day to day with forward and back arrows, and you can choose to view or hide the tasks you have due. This was all it did. It would have mild interest, but the problem it solves for me is the ease with which you can enter appointments. Click on the plus sign at the bottom for new appointments or new tasks, and you can quickly enter the event name and location and choose the calendar you want it to be put in. Then choose the time and set any notes you desire. I like the time entering so much more than the one in iCal now. I don't know what it is, but every time I'm trying to put in a time or something in iCal, it keeps beeping at me like I've hit a carriage return at some inappropriate time or something. Today is completely integrated in with iCal. When you're putting appointments and tasks into Today, they're actually going into iCal and vice versa. So the integration is completely seamless. It's not really syncing. You're actually accessing the same database, I think. Today does not allow you to invite people to an event that you create in there or add attachments, which I think it really should be if you want a full replacement for setting up appointments. I pretty much always have someone else I want to know about the appointment I'm making. Say it's Steve and I'm doing both of our haircuts, or Kyle, it's something I'm going to take him to the eye doctor or something. Or sometimes I'm inviting myself using my work email address to make sure it ends up on my work and home calendars since they sync to different devices. You also can't edit events that you've created or ones you're just viewing from iCal over in Today. You have to flip back over to iCal to edit those. Events you create in Today are instantly placed in iCal, like I said, and they sync to your iPhone or iPod Touch when you sync the next time. I mentioned at the beginning that my ADD kicks in pretty easily. If you have this problem too, you can choose to have Today float on top of all your other windows in case you need to be stared at in the face for the commitments you've made. Today is a handy little application that makes it very easy to create appointments and tasks on the fly. And it works seamlessly with iCal, has unusual flexibility in how it runs, and it's very pleasing to the eye. With the one enhancement to be able to invite people to appointments, I think Today would be perfect. Again, Today is $15 and is available at Second Gear. Thanks, Tim, and I'll talk to you soon. Well, it's been a week since I did that review for Tim, and guess what? I'm still using Today. In fact, when I wanted to know what the date for next week's show was, I used Today right while I was doing this recording. Justin Williams of Second Gear has graciously offered two licenses to be given away to NoSilicast listeners. Send me an email at allison@podfeet.com if you're interested. I'll do something tricky like, use a random number generator to calculate what the first what the winner will be from the different entries I get. But send on your emails to me at allison@podfeet.com, and I'll announce who the winners are on the next show. And once I get your emails, I'll forward the winning ones over to Justin, and he'll send you the license code. Well, I've been promising you guys something for a long time, and I finally started it on this holiday weekend. You've been asking me to do a podcast on podcasting. Well, I started it this weekend, and I worked up a couple of shows, and I'm going to keep working on more. I'll start sending them out, maybe one this week, one next week, probably middle of the week, and it'll come into the regular NoSilicast feed, but it's going to be an enhanced podcast because I know there's going to be things I'm going to want to show you in there. So check it out, and it's called Podcasting on Podcasting. It's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from bartbouchatz.ie. How are you today, Bart?
I'm good. I have internet. Yay!
Oh, it's grand. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I'm actually watching this whole Ustream thing now. So cool.
You're actually watching video on and having a chat at the same time.
And I'm still not going to read that chat while we're on the air.
So what did you finally end up getting?
I went for a company called Irish Broadband because they're the only people who offer package without bandwidth limits. So I'm assuming they have an unwritten sort of don't extract the urine policy, but other than that, we have no limit, no cap. So 3 megabits down and only 384k up, which is very asynchronous, but hell of a lot better than broken broadband, so I'm happy, I have to say. It's cheaper as well.
How much did you say up?
384k.
Okay, that's still respectable.
Yeah, but I had 2 megs up, in theory.
Yeah. But reality, you didn't.
Whereas in practice, I think I had 2K up. But anyway. So people can finally stop hearing me blather on about internets.
Yay. We'll find something else to be grumpy about. But we're done arguing about that. Now, we do still have a fair amount of lag. We have some folks watching on Ustream, and I can show them here that we do have about 200 milliseconds round trip, but that's not bad for us. That's pretty darn good.
Yeah, we're still crossing the giant big pond thing.
Yeah, I've got to give the interwebs a chance to get it here. Well, let's see. We had a couple things that we wanted to talk about today. First of all, I want to tell you yet another reason why iPhoto is stupid.
Shock horror.
Okay. So Steve's working with Photo to Movie that I reviewed last week, and he was having trouble with it, and a couple things were going wrong. And so I wrote to the developer, and the developer was great. And one of the things he asked was, how big were the photos in the slideshow? So if I'd been on my computer, I would have just popped open the folder where the drives were or where the photos were, and I just would have done a get info on the folder and found the size. But I go over to iMovie, and okay, you can kind of drill down into the library if you want at the Finder level. You can right-click and say Show Package and all that kind of stuff. But this time, I don't know, they buried it even more than before. I couldn't find the folder, so I couldn't do a get info, so I couldn't figure out how big the files were.
This is iPhoto or iMovie?
iPhoto.
Okay. All you do is select them and make sure the little info tab is open, and then it will say the date range from start to finish. It'll say how many items you've selected, and it'll give you their total size in megabytes.
Where?
So, okay, you see on the left-hand side you have your sort of sidebar.
Okay.
At the bottom of the sidebar you have 4 buttons.
Yeah.
One of which is an eye inside a circle.
Okay.
So if you click on that, the little information thingy will slide up or down if it was open already.
Okay.
So then just go select some photographs and watch the information come up there.
Oh. Never mind. I still hate it.
I know, you're just determined not to like it.
All right, fine. That doesn't make any sense. I want to see the real information. Well, this is just...
It is real.
It's going to be a bad show for me because I also have to confess that the last time that things screwed up with Time Machine, remember I was explaining on Steve's machine, he's got these huge video files, and so it's doing these updates really often, and you couldn't change it, so a bunch of people sent me recommendations on how you could adjust the time between the when it would do the backups. And so I was all excited. I was going to go set that up, go over to Steve's machine, and I discovered the real reason why Time Machine wasn't working was the drive wasn't mounting.
That may make a difference, all right.
It turns out it's really hard to run a backup if the drive isn't actually like mounted on the desktop. So I fussed around. I don't know why it stopped mounting. That's another question. But plugged it in, plugged it a couple times, got it to show up, and the backups have kind of been running for about a week now, 2 weeks without any trouble at all.
Excellent. Well, it's good to hear, because I know Steve does a lot of work, so it's good to know that he's nice and safely backed up.
Yeah, no off-site backups, but at least one day at a time, we've got some of that stuff backed up, so that's good while he's working on it anyway. But
exactly,
we had a big topic for today.
Yes, last Sunday was the birthday of my camera, and the fact that I know that is probably a little sad, but I do know it anyway. May the 18th, to be precise.
Well, yes, the birthday for both of us, because mine was right before that, just like a week or so before that, wasn't it?
I think you were a little longer, because when I went to order mine, you already had yours, and they already told me how great it was. Mine took a few weeks to arrive. So I think you got it early in the year, whereas I got it about May. It was entirely on your recommendation I bought it, and I like it, so thank you.
Good, I love mine.
Yes, no, I'm exceptionally happy with it, although I fear I'm starting to outgrow it, which is a little sad.
Now, what don't you like about it?
Well, it's not that I don't like. I mean, I think it is... Okay, what I loved about it when I got it is the very thing I'm now wishing it didn't do. Which is kind of ironic, I think, but compared to every other digital camera, which have, like, knobs and buttons everywhere... So you can change absolutely everything without ever going near a menu, and you just confuse the hell out of yourself and you don't know which way is up anymore. The D40 has none of that. It has very few buttons, and the menus let you do absolutely everything, and the menus are nice and easy to navigate, and they look pretty, and they just work. But it does mean that every time you want to change something, you're in the menus. whereas I actually now have got to the stage where I'm setting the camera on almost completely manual, and so I actually need to change stuff a lot. I'd like to be able to change my white balance without having to go into the menu. I'd like to be able to change my ISO without having to go into the menu. I'd like to be able to change my focusing mode without having to go into the menu. And you can do all that kind of stuff on the fancier models with all the the knobs and buttons covering every square inch of it, but you can't do that with the D40. So every time I'm shooting, it's like, click, take camera down, hit the menu button, scroll through the menus, click, and you know, the chances are at that stage the butterfly slash duck slash whatever has sod it off.
Now, I guess the reason this will be a good conversation is because your mileage may vary as you look at a camera like this, depending on what you're going to do. I don't mess with the settings very much at all. I don't find that it's a problem that I can't get to a lot of things. And the things I would have on buttons are different than what you would have on buttons. You'd have white balance, for example. I don't ever mess with white balance. I don't do anything on manual. What I'd like is a button, for example, to switch from single shot mode to multiple shot mode. Because I do all those track photos. I want to be able to just go flip it right away when I get to the track and just be able to do this rapid shooting.
Actually, I agree with that one. I'd like that one too. Now that we're on the subject of wish list, I'd like that too, actually. Although I don't use it, I think, even a quarter. I don't even use it about a tenth as much as you do, because you use it probably weekly. Whereas I use it when I'm shooting with the flash in conditions I probably shouldn't be and should probably have a tripod. And the theory being that as you press the shutter, you move the camera, and as you release the shutter, you move the camera. So if you press and hold for three shots, then you have two destroyed ones, but one solid one.
Oh, that's an interesting thing. I never thought of that.
It actually works very well. It's a little tip I think that was on TWIP, and it works. So the way if it's evening and you really, really can't bring the exposure any long or any shorter because you just won't see anything.
Right.
So you're like, well, I really shouldn't be doing this handheld without a tripod at 200 millimeters, but I'll give it a go anyway. Set it to rapid fire and just hold your finger down for 5 seconds, and the chances are one of the shots will be good.
Oh, that's a really good idea. I never would have thought about that. You say that I use the camera a lot. One of the things I was twittering about this week was the fact that I found out what happens when you pass the number 10,000 in the number of photographs you've taken in time on a single memory card. So I took my 10,000th photo while I was at a track banquet the other night. I think I took 187 pictures just at the banquet. And when I stuck my card in, I panicked because I had two folders on the drive. I was like, what the heck is this? And I look in the one folder and I flip over the other one, and the pictures happen to be fairly similar that I looked at. I was thinking, what, did it make a copy of every one of them? And suddenly I realized the last one in one folder was 9,999 and the first one was 0001.
And does it change the letters? Is it still DSC underscore?
No, it's still DSC underscore, and I think that's why it creates another folder to make sure it doesn't write over anything.
I suppose that's very polite of it.
So, and by the way, the way I tell this story to people, they easily get confused. I didn't have 10,000 pictures on one memory card. I never let it renumber itself. I let it just keep going sequentially.
It's much easier if you have every number just once, but unfortunately, that's not possible anymore. I didn't loop the whole way around. I got a new memory card when I hit 9,500, just because I wanted a new memory card that was bigger. Mm-hmm. So I, too, have two 001s, which is annoying.
Well,
what can you do?
Since I keep mine in nice little folders on my desktop instead of just slopped in a big pile in iPhoto, that's not a problem for me, Bart.
Mine is nicely organized in events by date, chronologically.
Yeah. That's
anyway, we're not going down that rat hole again. anyway, as we were saying, I think we had a point. So when I was new, I had seen other people's digital cameras and seen all those, you know, this mad array of buttons, and it scared the hell out of me. I was like, I don't know what to do with that. So when I saw the D40 and it was so simple and so easy to use, I was like, yes, this is the camera for me. And a year later, I still love it, but now I want the D80.
Which one?
My friend Peter in work has the D80, and I'm playing with it now whenever he brings it in, and all those little things that I'd like to be able to do with the D40, they're all on the D80.
Okay.
So I have buttons for changing my white balance, including a button for changing the exposure thingy, the shooting mode like you were looking for, all that stuff. Then it also does auto bracketing, which is something I'm starting to shoot quite a bit of HDR as required. I don't believe in doing it for the sake of it, but sometimes it really gets you out of a tricky situation. You get shots that are physically impossible without it. And I'm now limited by the fact that to do an HDR, I have to click the shutter, hold down the plus minus button, click the back wheel 3 times, click the shutter, hold down the plus minus button, click the back wheel either 3 more times to keep bracketing the same direction or 6 times the other way. You know, to get a 5-shot bracket takes a lot of clicks of a lot of buttons.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a day with clouds, you can't do it because the clouds will have moved significantly before you finish taking your brackets.
Whereas with auto bracketing, each time to dial all the little dials and the click, click, clicks.
Yeah, exactly. So clouds move quite a bit in 30 seconds in Ireland because it's almost never not windy. So it means that you end up with nasty looking clouds that either look stepped, so you can see the cloud from each exposure, so it has a jagged edge, or if you end up not using a bracket because it wasn't great, then you end up with a giant big gap, and it just doesn't look good. Whereas with the, you know, a camera that does automatic bracketing, you tell it, I'd like 5 brackets. You hit the shutter once and it goes click, 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 you know, 5 clicks as quick as it takes to take a photograph and you're done.
Hmm.
Well, and that, you know, that takes about a second. And clouds haven't moved that horrible amount. So I really miss auto bracketing. And the D80 has it. So whenever Peter's out shooting, he just has to press a button, goes click, 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 and he's happy. I can't do that. The other thing that I really like about the higher models is it has a display on the top. Sort of not an LCD, a little LED display, and it can tell all the big settings like what white balance you have set, what shooting moisture, and all that stuff on just a tiny little display at the top. And that's a lot handier than having the info button and look down.
Is that kind of what we have when we look inside the lens or inside the camera?
When we look inside, we have a very limited amount. You get more on the top of something like the D80.
I see that now.
So it would have everything. Yeah, it's very handy, especially considering the fact that you can change all those things without having to go into the menu, so having somewhere to see the change is kind of important.
Now, there's also the Nikon D60 that's between the D40 and the D80. Do you know much about that one and what it can do?
No, because I don't know anyone who has one, so I haven't played with it.
Okay, yeah.
I don't like reading about cameras. I just like to pick them up and play with them and make them go.
And actually, that's something you and I have both recommended to people, is that you really have to pick up a camera with your hand to appreciate whether you're going to like it. I had picked up probably 20 digital SLRs over the course of years. I kept thinking, I know I want to get a digital SLR, and I'd pick them up, and I'd go, okay, I'm really ready to spend $1,000 or whatever, and I'd pick them up, and they felt big and bulky and huge and heavy, and I just knew I wouldn't carry them if I had it. And the Nikon D40 is a lot smaller, I think, and it's a lot lighter, and it doesn't feel cheesy, though, but it just fit perfectly in my hands. The first time I picked it up, I knew I was sold.
Yeah, likewise, the D40 seems to be the shape of my hand. It fits so naturally. It's not heavy, but it does not feel plasticky. Whereas I've picked up the Canons in the same price bracket, and they felt really flimsy. They did not feel solid.
And yet, they felt big, light too, in a bad didn't way. They?
Perhaps a little. They felt clunky.
Yeah, yeah.
And the menus weren't as nice, and the D40 feels really good in my hand. As soon as I picked it up, I was in love with it. I was like, yes. And I distinctly remember picking up, I think it was someone's D350 from Canon, and I picked it up and I went, ooh. And then I started playing with the menus and I went, ooh. And I actually thought, maybe I want to go back to my old SLR film camera. Maybe I should bring it into a camera shop and get it repaired. Because my old film camera, I think it dates from the 70s, it's an Olympus OM1. And the shutter started sticking, which is the only reason I stopped using it. And I actually gave serious consideration to not bothering with this whole digital thing. And then I picked up a D40 and flicked through the menus and I thought, oh, wait, no, this is what I want. And I've been very happy with it, but I'm ready to move on at this stage. I've gotten to the point now where I can understand why you would want all the extra features. And the first time I picked up a D80, I didn't get it. I didn't see why it was better to have all those knobs and buttons everywhere than my nice little D40, which is so much easier to use. But now I get it, and now I want one. But at the same time, the D40 is still working very well. And actually, the only other thing I would change about the D40, I mean, it's only 4 things in total, and the only other one is I would like a few more megapixels. And the D40X has more megapixels. So, if you're buying a D40 now, I'd say go for the D40X, you'll have 10 megapixels, whereas we only have 6. But, 6 isn't too bad.
I don't get that. Why on earth do you want more megapixels?
So I can crop without things going pixely.
Well, how much do you crop? I mean,
It depends. Like, when I'm out shooting along the canal and stuff, and a duck decides to do something, I only have a 200mm zoom. It's not a lot, and ducks are small. So I'll see the perfect shot in there, but when I crop it down, there's very few pixels left. Whereas if I had a few more megapixels, there would be a lot more pixels left, and it would still be a very usable shot, even if I crop it down to, say, 1/5 the height and 1/5 the width.
Yeah, see, I don't know. Most of the stuff that I crop, well, let me say one thing, is a lot of people say they want a lot of megapixels because they want to do prints, but I haven't printed a photograph in over 2 years. I mean, it just doesn't even come up.
I've never printed a photograph.
What's that?
I've never printed a photograph. I have not printed a single photograph. I have a color printer, but it's not a photo printer, and I use it to print diagrams and charts and stuff. I have never printed a photograph.
But I mean, having anybody print it for me, or, you know, a photography lab or anything. I don't make physical copies of my photos anymore.
No. There's one physical copy of one of my photographs, which was framed, which printed by my dad and framed and given to my brother as a present, which is him and his wife and their daughter at Kaylee's christening. That's the only shot of mine that's ever been printed.
Yeah, I just don't see the need for it anymore. Doesn't come up to me. I mean, all my pictures are on Facebook, or they're up in some other photo sharing site, and I send them to people, email them, and everybody's happy. I do print a few photos here and there for my mom, but the megapixel myth to me is that you need that many megapixels to do a decent photo. I have a photograph that my buddy Ron took of my mom on her 80th birthday. So we all know mom's 87, about to be 88. So it's about 8 years ago. It was one of the original, it was a Nikon 990, one of the very first digital cameras they made. It's a 2-megapixel photograph. It's blown up to 5x7, and it is absolute perfection. You cannot see anything about that you wouldn't say it wasn't film.
Yeah. To me, though, I like to see my pictures full screen, and I use a lot of them as desktops. So to me, when I'm finished cropping, I need to have 1280 by 1050. And that's the amount of pixels I have to have left when I'm finished cropping. And if I have that, then I'm happy.
Okay, I'm looking for a calculator here. Let me bring up my LXVII there, my 67 calculator. How big did you say you had to have it?
It's 1680 by 1050.
1050? Okay, that would be 1.8 megapixels.
Okay, that's after cropping, though.
Right. That means you have to crop it from 6 megapixels down to 1.8. So you're going to get rid of more than 60% of the photograph. You'd still have, if you're cropping more than that, get closer to your subject.
You can't always. No, I like to have quite a bit of spare. Spare makes things good. It also means that you get a nicer image if you have a little bit to spare, because the icky JPEG artifacts are all in the rest of the image and not the bit you see. But no, I've run into limits on my 6 megapixels, where I've gone, oh, if only I had a few more. I certainly don't want 22 or any of that rubbish, but I'd like 10. I've come to the conclusion that 10 would suit me well.
See, now if you had 10, would you shoot 10 all the time, or would you just turn it up to 10 when you thought you needed a lot?
I'd probably shoot it all the time, because invariably I forget to change these kind of things when I can. I mean, in theory, I was thinking to myself, well, I'll shoot raw when I really need it. But do you know when I figure out that I need it? When I come to post-process the image.
right.
Oh, I really wish I'd shot that raw. That ain't going to help.
Well, are you going to invest in a bigger disk drive too?
I haven't quite decided what to do at the moment. I'm stone broke, so nothing's going to happen for a while. But I imagine I'm going to get a little external hard drive or something and use it for my photo library or something. So I am going to start shooting RAW at some stage. Probably soon.
Yeah, but anyway, I think it's good that we're both talking about this, because our perspectives are very different. I definitely don't want more megapixels. In fact, I probably don't even need to shoot it at 6 as often as I do. Because the kind of photography I do, it just doesn't require it. I can get closer to the runner in general, I can get closer to the flower or whatever it is I'm shooting, that I'm rarely shooting something that's far away that I need to do a lot of cropping. I think people listening should really look at what their actual needs are, what they think they're going to need, and not necessarily listen to either one of us, maybe.
Well, yeah, and the other thing is, of course, is the only way to really know for sure is to do it, and at which point you're going to find yourself like me going, okay, now I need a better camera.
Yeah.
I suppose the other thing to mention is not all megapixels are born equal, and you should absolutely on no account judge a camera by its megapixels. If someone starts saying to you, oh, no, don't buy that camera, buy this one because it has more megapixels, they don't know what they're talking about and don't listen to them.
So
it really is that simple.
Because it's really more about the lens? Is that why you're saying that?
No. If you can imagine, megapixels are just little buckets in little holes, effectively, that collect electrons, which are triggered by the light. There's a little grid of them. That's what your sensor is. It's just a little grid of little buckets that collect electrons every time light hits them. And if you know, they're the same size. The sensor is the same size in all affordable DSLRs. The only time you get bigger sensors is when you pay many, many thousands of euro. So there's only so much physical room, and if you cram in more little buckets, you actually don't necessarily end up with a better image, because the buckets have gotten smaller, they're more prone to noise, they may not be of as good a quality, they may leak little electrons and stuff. So megapixels is not a way to judge a camera.
Actually, you know, it's funny that you would bring that exact thing up. Back when my buddy Ron and I both had Casio XLM cameras, he had bought one version of it, and shortly after he bought his, I bought one that was way cooler because it had more megapixels. And right after that, I read an article that explained exactly what you said, and they used my camera as the example of why you shouldn't.
Oh,
do
no!
It. But I confessed to Ron that I just did it to irritate him, and that I was paid back for it. So,
the universe has turned around and told you not to do that again.
Exactly. But I think both of us could say we're both been really, really happy with the D40. The quality of photographs is fantastic for the price. I mean,
absolutely.
This is a $500 camera we're talking about, guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's a year old. I haven't shot any pictures since last Sunday, so it's a year old. My library currently numbers 2,725 images in 158 events.
Hmm.
I think that speaks for itself.
If it wasn't making me happy, you wouldn't be
rigorous editor. I mean, you know, unlike yourself, I edit brutally. So, you know, I've shot easily probably more than 10 times more than that.
Okay. I've been meaning to have this argument with you, too. You say, unlike you do this editing brutally. I edit brutally, but you realize what I'm taking photographs of. I'm not taking 100 pictures of the same silly little flower here. I'm taking 500 pictures of 300 kids or 150 kids. So, I mean, I'll drop the number of pictures way down, but a lot of times it'll be like a sequence of a jumper, for example, and the photographs are interesting because of they're a sequence. So there'll be six pictures of one kid in a row. I'll get rid of the fuzzy ones, you know, the out of focus, the badly exposed ones, that kind of thing. But if it's a picture of a kid and that parent gets a chance to see a picture of their kid doing something where they didn't get to go to the track meet, that stuff's golden. Why would I get rid of that? So I do edit.
Yeah, I suppose. It's a little different, all right. I shoot for me rather than for 300 parents, which is probably a lot easier.
Yeah, but, oh, man, I've gotten so much fun out of doing it. I started out taking, you know, maybe 25, 30, 40, 50 pictures at a meet, and then somebody would say, oh, did you get any pictures of the freshman girls? And pretty soon I had to stay at every meet. I had to go to every meet. I had to stay for every race, and I took a picture of every kid that I could find. And the parents just loved it. I remember a friend of mine saying she was so happy I got a picture of her daughter Katie because she was on travel and she couldn't make the meet. And it just made her feel really good that she got to see how Katie did in the race. So,
yeah, I suppose that's almost sort of like being a professional. You're shooting for others almost.
Yeah. And we put it all up on a little blog and everybody loves it. And they send me little notes saying how wonderful I am. And you know how well I respond to a pat on my little pumpkin head. So
nothing little about that blog.
Well, have we covered everything about the Nikon D40 and what you'd do different next time?
Yeah, really, for me, it boils down to those four things. I want exposure bracketing. I want more buttons to edit stuff rather than the nice menus. I want a little LED display at the top to tell me what everything is set up. And I want a couple more megapixels, but not too many. And really, they're the only complaints I have. And to be honest, that's just because I've outgrown the D40 a little. I mean, I used to shoot all the time on the A mode. And then I started shooting... changing it from, say, from A to the little portrait, or from A to the little landscape, or from A to the little, the little macro one or whatever. And then I started shooting aperture priority, and then I started setting the ISO manually, and then I started setting the white balance manually. And before you knew it, I was setting just about everything manually. And now that I'm doing all this stuff manually, I want those extra buttons, which made no sense to me before. So I think the D40 is a fabulous, fabulous camera for anyone who's starting out. Anyone who is even remotely afraid of this whole DSLRs are complicated thing. You can use the D40 as a point and click. You set it to the A mode, you point at what you want, and you click. And then, as you decide that you want to learn more because something has come up that's quite challenging and isn't working well in the A mode, you have the power to do it all. So, to me, it's the perfect next step from a point and shoot.
I would say that I am the perfect counter example because I pretty much keep it all on that, you know, that A mode or program mode, I guess, is the one I keep it on. And I do almost everything just point and shoot, but it's got a good lens and I can really zoom up on people. I love the effect I can get where I'm relatively close to someone, say a kid in the stands, maybe I'm, I don't know, three or four benches away, and I can put the big zoom in on it and zoom right up on him and get this fabulous shallow depth of field, really sharp focus on this kid that doesn't know that I'm getting a picture of them. In the casualness of a track meet is really, there's a lot of fun that goes on in the sidelines, and I've gotten some really great candid photos of people that way, and that sharp, shallow depth of field with a big zoom, oh, I just love it. And I just had it on program the whole time.
Yeah, you can do an awful, awful lot, really nice shots when you have it just on its automatic modes, and it has a fair few of the automatic modes. I presume the little running man comes in handy for you, or something. Yes. I've ever used.
See, that's the perfect one. The little running man is where I pretty much leave it there most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, the fact is you have the power there, so when you need to, you can do all sorts of cool stuff, like when you had the guys holding the candles and you stuck on the very, really fast lens.
Right.
And you got the shot with no flash.
And I had
you know,
it on...
You just can't do that with real point and shoot, but with the D40 you can.
Exactly, exactly. Well, we've been going on for 27 minutes now, so our 15-minute show is almost up.
Yeah, for us, a minute is 120 seconds. Did we not tell everyone else about that redefinition?
Yeah, but nobody seems to have a problem with it. And now, finally, to have good sound quality, that's been really, really fun, Bart. I think everyone has a selective cheer for your new broadband, finally.
Not half as much as me. I was going insane.
All right, Bart. Well, we're going to talk to you next time.
Okay, until next time, happy computing.
Gosh, it was so much fun to hear Bart clearly. What a relief. It's also nice to know this will be stable for a long time, too. No wondering where Bart is going to borrow a cup of internet, you know? Wow, would you believe I cut some stuff out of this show? I know it went long, but I just couldn't figure out where to cut it. People are pretty forthcoming about complaining to me about the show, I can tell you that. But the one thing no one, yet, has complained about is that the show is too long, so I guess it's okay. Please keep all your emails coming. You know I just love to hear from you guys. Send them on over to allison@podfeet.com. And if you have the nerve, like George, to learn how to make an audio recording, send it along to nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.